Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Spring is here and many plants and trees are beginning to bloom. And new research has found blooming trends are being impacted by climate change. Each month, WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz speaks with Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science Paul Rober as a part of our Climate Conversation series. This month, they're joined by fellow UW-Milwaukee Distinguished Professor Mark Schwartz. His home is in the Geography Department, and his research focuses on how the climate impacts plant life, particularly during spring and autumn. Schwartz and Rober are working on a research project together that could help us better understand how agriculture is being impacted by climate change. Mark begins by describing his research.
Well, basically, my research has been focusing on the beginning and now to some degree the end of the growing season. And it really has come from a very long-term realization that there was this interaction between the atmosphere and biological activity, particularly plants, and that phenological events, these rather simple things that we can observe in nature, like plants, the leafing and blooming at the beginning of the growing season, are really an indicator of much more detailed and more comprehensive interactions that are going on between the atmosphere and the biosphere. So in many ways, it's taking something that has been known and done in a lot of areas for a very long time, that is taking careful observations of plants and those changes and bringing it into a more modern context where we're understanding that these changes are, and in fact, something that is telling us something about rather complex processes that are going on. And so what a lot of the work that I've been trying to do is to figure out how to use a lot of the instruments that we have available to us, to use the satellite data that we have available to us, to tie all of these things together, because like a lot of things in science, we never have all the data that we really would like from one individual source. And we have to figure out how to stitch together things from a lot of different sources. And then of course the advantage is when they're all telling you similar things. As I've said, in many contexts, when we look at the satellite data and see the changes there, we look at the temperature data, we see the changes there, and then we can tie this all to visible changes in plants and animals, particularly at these sensitive times, the beginning and the end of the growing season. It really tells us that we're seeing real change, and it gives us an opportunity to explore it in more detail.
So I want to go back to what you've been observing, the changes that you are finding in multiple ways. But Paul Rober, you and Mark started collaborating earlier this year. Can you talk about what that collaboration, how far are you into it, and what do you hope to learn through it?
These sort of long-term effects are apparent in some of Mark's research and other people who look at that, but no one has really looked at what the impact on short-term forecasting might be. And we use a lot of numerical weather prediction models, and they model kind of the interaction between the surface layer, which includes plants, and the atmosphere. But many of these models are not very sophisticated in how they do that. For example, they don't really have much more than, say, a seasonal switch that gets flipped on, and that may be, you know, tied to a particular date. So the sort of transitions that Mark talks about are not really incorporated in those models. So we theorize that there might be a time period when that is going on, especially if it's earlier than usual or later than usual, where the models are not really seeing that. That might introduce some amount of error. So the forecast skills should go down during those time periods. So we wanted to see if that was true. First of all, if we could see anything at all, and second of all, if it made any real difference, like if it was significant at all as far as forecasts were concerned. So we started looking at that. We put together a lot of the data. I had to get some of the data that Mark needed to do his magic, and so he's been working on that since then. So it'd be a good time to ask Mark where we're at with that.
Basically, we've accomplished several of the things. I mean, not surprisingly, given the earlier research that had been done, that we find that there is an actual identifiable change that you can find statistically when you look at these forecasts over time, and it does change in the way that, we would expect. The problem with a lot of these things is that in order to look at this, we're looking at changes over 10 years over a number of multiple sites. And so the first question is whether the size of the changes are actually significant enough from the point of view from a forecast to actually make a difference in an individual year at an individual place. So that's kind of one of the overriding questions that we will still have to look at and won't be answerable immediately. The second one that I'm trying to deal with, and I suppose that I could say I have been delayed a little bit because I have a graduate student that I'm wanting to work on this, and hasn't been able to get to it for the last month or so. So he's hoping to do that later. But we're trying to actually show that I've looked at one particular situation and been able to figure out how much of a change there is at these approximately 300 stations that we're looking at across the central and eastern U.S. And I want to relate this to the actual amount of vegetation that's around the stations, because we want to be able to have some sense of the causality. So in principle, the variations that I'm seeing don't seem to show any particular pattern in terms of, say, like general geography, but I'm hoping that the variations that I'm seeing are being caused by differences in the amount of vegetation cover around the stations, or at least I'm hoping to see that there is some relationship there. And once we have that, then I think we'll be able to move forward with presenting this in a way that the scientific community can scrutinize it a little bit more, and then really get to that ultimate question, which is there enough of a variation? I don't think there's any question that the vegetation is causing a change. I think the question is the change large enough to make a difference for a forecaster in an operational sense? And so that's sort of the ultimate pursuit of this that will take a bit of time to get to.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, Susan, the forecasters now, I don't think, are even really aware that this might be an issue. And so that's what we're trying to focus on, to make sure that once we quantify this, we'll know exactly how much of a magnitude the effect is, and whether or not forecasters should really be aware of that as they're making a forecast, you know, something about what the green up progression is, or in the fall when things are going in the other direction, to understand that and how that affects the forecast.
Because we have right now the USA NPN has, during the springtime, a product that's available that is tracking the green wave daily. First of all, that product, and something perhaps more sophisticated than that product, would be something that the forecasters could look at just to know where the changes are in their local area, so to speak. And also the other thing we're looking to do is that we are looking at things in the central and eastern U.S. where there's a lot of vegetation cover, because obviously it would make sense that these impacts would be greater where there was more vegetation, and say places of the country where there isn't much vegetation cover, like the southwestern U.S., these effects may not be visible or may be more difficult to deal with.
So, Paul, when we were talking about this conversation, and there is so much to cover, and there's a great deal of research that you both have done in your fields, but you stated that biomes are changing, and they'll continue to change in response to climate change. That's a big deal. So, what's a way that we can sort of dig into that in a meaningful way?
Well, a simple way to think about it is in the Midwestern U.S., if you go further south, there's a lot of grassland that's historically been the kind of growth that's in those areas. And further north, it's more forest or mixed forests and other kinds of natural growth. And what you would expect, all else being equal, with climate change, that should just migrate northwards. So the grasslands would be moving north, the forests would be moving north. So perhaps places like Minnesota and Wisconsin would have much more grassland and much less forest than we do now. So that's kind of a very simple way of thinking about it. Obviously, the reality is more complicated, but there are maps that are already showing what those changes would look like in Wisconsin, for example, mid-century. So we have some idea of how those changes should occur. So it's a pretty much a foregone conclusion that that'll happen on the present path. There's just no reason why that should change.
Mark, do you want to pop in on that?
Well, it's complicated because the process of the change involves species migrations. And of course, this is the idea of invasive species. And some of them are taking advantage of these niches. And the process of change is a very complicated one. In the very old days of science, they talked about sort of large-scale processes taking place and things kind of reaching some sort of penultimate state. And now we understand that it's much more complicated than that. And human activities also complicate this because, you know, if we imagine the landscape as it was originally, the trees and the things would be moving. But now we have other kinds of barriers and other kinds of issues. And then we have people moving things around as well, these pests and other kinds of things that, you know, for example, the emerald beetle that's unfortunately 45% of the trees in Downer Woods are white ash, so they are right now in the process of dying. And so a lot of Downer Woods is going to be dead, and they're trying to plant some new trees to take their place, but that's not a process that happens in years, this happens in decades. So unfortunately, the status of Downer Woods in some way is going to be a microcosm of what's going to be happening in terms of climate change. In that case, the death is being caused rather quickly on the large scale in maybe a decade or so. But these processes happen on the decadal and the century time scale, and takes a long time for forests to move. So it's kind of an easy thing to say in a simple sense of what that there are going to be these changes, but the actual process of change is quite messy and difficult to contemplate.
Insects in particular, that's part of this overall migration also, as you've probably heard about, that a particular area becomes much more suitable for certain species that weren't before. And so they move into those areas, and whatever the natural system is, the ecosystem is like before that, gets dramatically altered as the species have come in and they're not adapted to deal with that kind of species. So there's a whole transformation that occurs. And as Mark pointed out, you know, that's not a very linear process. There's a lot of punctuated things that happen, feedbacks that happen in all manner of directions. He mentioned human influence on that too, which is a further complicating factor. So we do know that these changes are happening. You can already see them have happened. One of the things that we've noticed for quite a while is that with the general warming that's occurred, many species are migrating to higher altitudes where they have that ability to do that, so that eventually you run out of altitude, and so those species then either they found another place to live or they just die out because there is no place for them. So there's those kinds of things that are happening too. So as Mark pointed out, it is a very complicated process, but there are sort of general principles that you can understand how that plays out.
The other reason that I like the phenology is because it's a way for individuals. It's very easy for me when I go and I talk about this to say to people, and you can observe this yourself. So I can point out to them that they can go out, they can look at the plants in their backyard, and they can connect themselves with pretty sophisticated things that are going on. This transition that takes place every year in the spring when we sort of green up, and then in the fall to a lesser degree, because it's a bit more complicated when things die out and senesce. It's a way for people to be connected with this, and it's also a way for them to realize that these changes aren't just some theoretical thing, that they're actually happening. and also to understand how complicated it is, how variable it is from year to year. We have had two of the earliest starts of the beginning of the growing season in 2012 and 2017 that we've had over the more than a decade that I've simulated this with my data. And yet I've been kind of bemoaning for the past few years, we've had really cool springs in this part of the country, and not so much in the southeast. It's been warm there, but then everything has slowed down, and this sort of pocket over the north central states has been particularly late. So we're seeing a tremendous amount of variability here, some of the earliest starts of spring and then some that have been quite late. And I think Paul probably would say that's perhaps another thing, the variability, although there isn't a lot of complete detail on that, but that kind of bouncing around may be something that's related to the long-term dynamics of the system. That's more Paul's expertise than mine.
Right. Well, we've talked about variability in the context of, for example, lake levels as being a more significant factor than people realize. And this is something that people are becoming more aware of also in terms of just general climate extremes, that variability. So it's yes, there's a general warming, let's say, but it doesn't mean it's always warm in one particular place and it's always going to linearly increase. If it was 10 degrees this time of year last year, it's going to be 12 degrees this year. It just doesn't work that way. There's a lot of bouncing around that. And so the variability aspect is something that I believe will become a very active area of research. I think there's only a little bit of work that's being done in that area right now. There has been more work that's been done in terms of extreme storms and attribution of that to climate change, which has become a lot more sophisticated than it used to be. So it's possible now to talk about the probability of a particular size event having occurred now versus without climate change, which we couldn't say before. So you still can't really say that that particular storm happened because of climate change, but you can say the likelihood of a storm like that happening increased by X percent because of climate change.
And I guess one last quick thing that I would say, that the other interesting thing is that last frost dates, if we talk about the start of the growing season, are in effect a completely separate event that are triggered by more individualized things. And that's one of the biggest threats that I see changing at the beginning of the growing season, is that these two things operate differently. And so we're going to see a trend towards more warmth earlier, which is going to have plants starting to grow sooner. But the frost dates still coming around and being able to zap them relatively late in the season. And so I think that the threat of damage to agriculture at the beginning of the growing season is something that I would anticipate seeing continuing to change as we go forward.
Paul Roberts, a Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at UW-Milwaukee. Mark Schwartz is a Distinguished Professor of Geography, also at UWM. They both spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz.